Hello, and welcome to another edition of Brussels Sprouts. I'm Andrea Kendall-Taylor.
And I'm Jim Townsend.
And we're so glad you can join us. You know, it's been a few months since French President Emmanuel Macron's NATO brain death speech, and a few more weeks it's been since his encore performance at the Munich Security Conference, where he sustained his calls for strategic autonomy, and because one was hard on the Europeans and the United States about the hard line they're taking against Russia. But questions, I think, about French foreign policy, Emmanuel Macron's thinking, continue to percolate. And so we brought together two of our favorite French experts today. We've got Ben Haddad and Elise Pannier. And for those of you who don't know Ben and Elise, Ben is the director of the Future Europe Initiative at the Atlantic Council. And he's the author of Paradise Lost, Europe in the World of Trump, which was published last year. And in 2017, Ben was the Washington, D.C. representative of Macron's movement En Marche. And Alice is the assistant professor of international relations and European studies at Johns Hopkins. She has a focus on defense policies of France, the U.K., and Germany. And she also has a forthcoming book, The Rise of U.K.-France Defense Relations in the 21st Century, which will be out this October. So welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's great to see you all. And you know, a lot of you Brussels Sprouts listeners don't know this, but I'll be going off to Sciences Po in just a couple of days. I cannot wait. So I look on myself right now. There's three. Two are French, and the other is
honorary.
Yeah. And so you're outnumbered, Andrea, just so you know that.
Yeah, that's okay. I'll ask all the questions, and you guys can do all the answering. And so maybe to that end, maybe just start just to ease our way into the conversation and talk a little bit about both of your views on what shapes Macron's worldview, kind of what you see as the factors that are driving his foreign policy.
Yeah, well, I think one interesting thing to look at when you think about Macron's foreign policy is look at where he comes from domestically, politically, right? So when he ran for president, it was the first time he ever ran for office. He had never been a member of a political party before. He's a liberal. He's a pro-European. The term he uses in French is progressive. He is called a centrist. But at the same time, he is really someone who came of age politically in the time of populism. His worldview is deeply shaped by this. It's deeply shaped by the fact that he broke with the right-left divide and brought together with En Marche the progressive pro-European forces, the center-right and center-left, to create a political answer to the rise of populism. And I think that also informs his worldview, which is that he is someone who considers that the world is changing, that Brexit or the Trump election, not accidents, but they're symptoms of a deeper restructuring of the world system, a backlash against the liberal world order as we know it, against multilateralism, that our institutions need to be deeply reformed, that the EU needs to be deeply reformed. He's a pro-European who doesn't shy away from criticizing the EU and saying it should make the case that it can protect its citizens, that it can protect its borders, that it can reassert its power on the world stage, that it can compete in great power competition, in a way capturing some of the rhetoric, some of the appeal of the populist, but reframing it with a pro-European liberal objective and narrative. And so I think there's a real connection between the domestic element of his worldview and how he wants to project it on the world stage.
Yeah, I think he combines two trends or visions, and one was more dominant, I think, in my perception at the beginning of his presidency, is the realist or pragmatic version of foreign policy, where especially at the beginning of his presidency, it was really emphasizing the need to defend the French national interests. It was all about national interests, talking to world leaders, including those with whom we don't share the same values, talking to Erdogan, talking to Putin, talking to Trump, and having this pragmatic approach to, for example, the civil war in Syria. You know, he famously said in an interview that Bashar al-Assad is the enemy of the Syrian people. It's not the enemy of France. The enemy of France is Daesh and the terrorists. That was especially strong at the beginning of his presidency. And then I think driven by the events on the international stage and this kind of leadership vacuum among liberal democracies, he became more and more this spearhead of the liberal world and has emphasized more and more the liberal ideas and with a new emphasis on idealism in a way that he was really not putting forward in his speeches in the first year, for example, of his presidency. So I think he's really trying to balance both visions that really nurture his positions, and sometimes striking the balance right is difficult between pragmaticism and realism on the one hand and liberalism and idealism on the other hand.
You know, the one thing you hear around town here in Washington is that Macron is the only one that seems to have any strategic vision at all or any new ideas or any fresh approach. You know, whether it's the interview where he talked about NATO being brain dead, which was misquoted, as you know, or at least the context was. That was actually a very good interview. I really enjoyed that. But, you know, every time I listen to him, and as I said, I like what he says. Important as I'm going to Paris, I want to be led in the country. But other than that, I keep thinking that he must feel awfully frustrated and alone because, you know, the Germans don't jump up and down and say, we'll follow you. And he gets a lot of probably some, you know, cynical responses from some of the other countries that don't want to follow France. And so there he is putting out these ideas, and he turns around and there's no one behind him. By now, how frustrated must he be?
I think he's facing the same set of constraints, if we want to draw a parallel between the domestic scene and the international scene, where he's a reformist, right? So he's trying to reform France, and he's also trying to reform Europe and even the international system.
And reform NATO as well.
Reform NATO, reform the EU, and just also reform the way international relations are being conducted because it's no longer working, right? So so he's frustrated, I would imagine, by not being followed, either domestically or internationally, by despite all of his great ambitions.
Yeah, no, I think the comparison with the domestic scene here is interesting because he is someone who rose politically on the ashes, basically, of the establishment, and considers, okay, we need to do things, we need to be disruptive, we need to get things done. And I sense a form of frustration in Paris right now because there is a form of a loneliness in the French position. I think especially he came in office in 2017 with a very ambitious, broad agenda for the European Union, a Europe that protects, gave that speech at Sorbonne, which included both reform, domestic reforms, integration of the Eurozone, more democracy and swifter decision-making for the EU, but also an EU that reconciles itself with power on the world stage, that invests in its defense integration, EDF, PESCO, the European Intervention Initiative, etc. And he feels that there was no response, basically, coming from Berlin. Right. And that I think especially the idea that Germany was probably trying to wait Trump out and didn't see what was happening as structural, whereas I think the French have a sense that there's a deeper realignment from U.S. power and the Europeans should just take more responsibility and be more self-reliant. We've seen an inflection in this in two ways in the last year. The first one is more unilateralism coming from Paris, a more disruptive approach, and you see this with his opening to Russia, and I think you see this in the blunt rhetoric that he's using in an interview like in The Economist, which, by the way, I think is kind of refreshing. I mean, I've heard lots of people in think tanks here saying, well, of course he's right, but we shouldn't say so. And if, you know, you're in a think tank and you're more prudent than a head of state, you know, what's your role? But the second pillar, I think, of that realignment is also trying to find new partners, build new coalitions. He was in Warsaw recently, and you can see, and Jean-Yves Le Drian, the foreign minister, also did a pretty successful trip to Prague. So you can see that there's also a strategy to sort of reach out to new partners. I think there was a little bit of a wasted opportunity the first 2 years in investing so much in the bilateral relationship with Berlin and the personal relationship with Chancellor Merkel at the expense of finding other partners that, and by the way, this is very French, that we had overlooked for a long time, even before Macron, of course, you know, especially Central and Eastern European countries.
Yeah, I do think that if we want to see the glass half full, that there have been a few successes, including trying to successfully raise interests among Europeans about the Sahel, for example, right? And that combines both new partners, I mean, both partners such as Spain, so old traditional partners, and Germany and the UK, but as well as new partners, Estonia, Denmark, and those countries are also involved in the European Intervention Initiative, which is a demonstration of the appeal that it had towards new partners, and it's growing in number. Three new countries joined it in the past year, Finland, Sweden, Norway, and Italy finally joined after the change in government. So this worked to attract new partners. And again, the EU, with the new commission especially being quite ambitious when it comes to defense and foreign policy, is France's best ally at the moment, and it's allowing Macron to have some victories, even though, for example, when it comes to the European Defense Fund, the budgets are likely to be half of what was expected of the sort of maximalist French vision for that project. But there are still some wins and some victories, and on the Libya case, there has been a rapprochement between France and Italy in dealing with the question. So things are also improving in certain aspects. So we shouldn't be completely negative in our assessment. And also when it comes to the U.S.'s approach to Africa and the Middle East, we see that there is some support on the part of the Congress and parts of the DOD to keep investing in those regions that are of concern to France. So it's not all bleak.
Well, it's interesting thinking about the power dynamic with the UK being out. And I've said this in a couple of places that around town here in the think tanks, you hear people talking about France and Germany, and the UK doesn't pop up much. For obvious reasons. But I wonder with Macron, with the UK out, in some ways the UK was a good partner for France in dealing with the European issues. In some cases, or many cases, it was not. But it was part of a power triangle between the three countries. Now it's just two countries. And so I wonder with Macron, does he look across the English Channel and go, gosh, I wish those guys were still around. I could really use the help. Or is it like, well, they're not there, which is great. That kind of no more monkey wrenches in the works, and I can work with Germany, and we can really move the EU. I mean, where is he in looking across that English Channel?
Well, the UK is an extremely important partner for France. It's in terms of defense, it's the main partner, right, in Europe. Obviously, the relationship with Germany is extremely important, but it covers, a much more diverse sets of issues, and it's always considered in the context of European integration. And keeping the Germans on board is extremely important for building consensus among Europeans. With the UK, it's entirely different. It's a relationship that is driven by, a de facto convergence between the two countries when it comes to strategic issues, the parallels in their strategic positions and foreign policies and expeditionary postures, and the position of nuclear deterrent, right? So the UK is really, really important. And there is a lot of sadness in France with the UK leaving the EU, but especially because of how it affects the UK's outlook, right? And the fact that the UK has been increasingly absent from international conversations. And so it's almost by default, right, that the French president has to turn to Germany, although every single French president has done that, trying to balance the relationship with the UK, the relationship with Germany. They're not mutually exclusive because, we have this format of the E3 that is extremely important for European diplomacy, for managing issues, from Iran to Russia, to any other international issue that requires the big three to come to an agreement. And it's also the UK, obviously, part of the P3, which is another extremely important format for French foreign policy within the UN Security Council. And there had been in the past few years increasing trilateral cooperation between France, UK, and the US. And so it's extremely important for France to keep the UK anchored, but also to keep it engaged. And but it depends on what the UK wants to do and can afford to do. And the question mark, has persisted ever since 2016. And I think that's where that's why we're not seeing much progress at the moment. But I think, we're going to look towards the anniversary of the Lancaster House treaties, the bilateral UK-French treaties in November. And the French have great ambitions for renewing those treaties and coming up with new areas for cooperation with the UK. And so, you know, it's up to the UK to seize that opportunity as well to come to an important 10th anniversary and set a new path forward for the UK-French relationship.
Yeah, historically, there's always been a lot of frustration in Paris with the UK's role within the European community and the European Union. Obviously, de Gaulle vetoed the UK's initial accession within the European community, saying there will always be sort of an awkward member. They will always be closer to the United States than to Europe. This was lifted then in the 70s. You had a lot of tensions in the 80s with Margaret Thatcher's call for the rebate. But at the end of the day, despite these frustrations and tensions, Brexit was obviously considered bad news in Paris. And I think France tried to uphold, I would say, three principles in the Brexit negotiations these last few years. One was really keeping European unity on the four freedoms, on the support for Ireland, and not breaking apart. And I think it's no coincidence that that Michel Barnier is French and he has a close relationship with Macron and the Élysée. The second one was making sure that these Brexit negotiations don't get dragged on for years, because it was seen in Paris as a form of distraction from all the real issues that Macron wants to push on the European agenda. So we saw in the last few months a sort of interesting convergence between Boris Johnson and Emmanuel Macron, both of them wanting to end the negotiation, right, and finally uphold Brexit. And the third one was also no complacency, and basically use Brexit as a warning, as a wake-up call for Europeans. That was the opening of Macron's European renewal letter before the European election, saying, you know, it's not because we managed to keep European unity, it's not because we see divisions in Britain that this should be cause for good news. On the contrary, a lot of the challenges that led to Brexit are still here in the European Union. We're seeing this with the recent migration crisis just right now. And so I think seeing this more of as a wake-up call for Europeans. Now that Brexit is done, and Alice knows much more about this than I do, clearly I think the idea is to keep the UK as anchored as possible to the developments in European defense, as really a member of European foreign policy. This is why Macron has pushed different defense initiatives that don't fit within the strict EU format, obviously the European Intervention Initiative, and also this idea of the European Security Council that would include the UK. I think we're entering, by the way, a really interesting time, including for people like us, where there's going to be space to reshape, to rethink some of these institutions and these relationships. The last few years have been so tied to day-to-day UK domestic politics and how many votes we're going to get at the House of Commons from this or that withdrawal agreement. I think now there's going to be more space for creativity in London, Paris, or DC.
Yeah, I think a lot is going to come or not from London. I mean, considering that the current Johnson government has, downplayed their ambitions when it comes to participate one way or another to EU foreign and security and defense policy formats, hopefully that was just for short-term political gains, and that's not a long-term strategy for them, because that if they're not in one way included in EU settings, even though we have alternatives outside of the EU for collaborating, I think it will further lead to a shift between the EU and the UK.
Ben, you mentioned Macron looking for opportunities to reshape institutions, reshape relationships, and I think nowhere is that more apparent than in his approach to Russia. And so we've, you know, heard him talk about the fact that the United States in Europe, the West in general, has taken an overly hardline approach to Russia. And because of their kind of long-term prospects in terms of their economy and perhaps demographics, and notably their deepening relationship with China, he thinks that there needs to be a different type of relationship. Is that what's driving this? I mean, in my mind, it seems like his position on this is really driven by, I would almost say, a misunderstanding of Russian political dynamics. And so I just would love to hear your views on if that is what's driving Macron, if not, what is it? And then also a little discussion between all of us on the implications that's having for cohesion in Europe and in the EU.
Yeah. First, one thing that's interesting is that actually started at the very beginning of his presidency. He invited Vladimir Putin to Versailles a week into his presidency. People remember press conference where he confronted Putin about the interference of RT and Sputnik within the French presidential campaign. Nonetheless, he still invited him to talk about terrorism and cooperation in the Middle East, and that was a little lost in the conversation. And to Alice's previous point, he sees himself as a realist that needs to talk to everyone. If you look at his language on Russia, what is he saying? First, he's saying this is something very long term. It might take 10 or 15 years. And I think he has the idea of saying, look, we have to find a way to work with Russia. It's Europe's neighbor. We have to respect Russia's interest and find a way to integrate this within the European security architecture. A lot of people had expected him to throw Zelensky under the bus at the last Normandy format or weaken his position on Ukraine, but it hasn't been the case so far. Macron's policy on Ukraine, view on Ukraine, has always been a clear implementation of the Minsk II agreement. France is still a partner, a party to the EU sanctions, but at the same time saying the only way we can get Russia to implement Minsk II is by shaping a more interesting future for them in their relationship with the United States and Europe, and sort of upgrading, I think, the security relationship. I think when you talk about his understanding of Russian interests, basically, I think Macron views Russia as a country that has cornered itself in the last 20 years, right? That is more and more aligning itself with China, which is neither in Russia nor in the European Union's interest. I think Macron sees the rivalry with China, the relationship with China, as a broader strategic challenge, and so he feels it's better to have Russia on Europe's side, especially at a time when the United States is progressively withdrawing from the European continent, and that the way to do this is by trying to basically tell Russia, look, if we manage to work on Ukraine together, if we manage to work on arms control together on the European continent, then we're not going to go to the status quo ante, just lifting sanctions. We're going to go to an improved strategic relationship with you. I think, you know, the main challenge I see to this is that this has been tried by American presidents, and you would expect Moscow to be more attentive to initiatives coming from the United States than coming from not only Europeans, but only one European country. So I just don't know, even if it could be intellectually sound, strategically sound, I don't know how much political clout and impact it can have coming just from France and Moscow.
Yeah, I think we can either see his ambition as being unfulfillable, because the ambition would be to, okay, have Russia on Europe's side in a confrontation in the great power competition with China. So that seems difficult to implement, and it's a longer term goal. And how much leverage does Europe actually have to have Russia on its side, to convince it to be on Europe's side?
Or what Russia would be willing to concede to get there.
Right, exactly. That seems difficult to implement. But I think there are other more pragmatic short-term goals that can be achieved simply by reinstitutionalizing dialogue, which has been suspended. And you can have a dialogue even with a country that you disagree with, but you can agree to disagree, but at least talk about it. And in order to first avoid strategic surprises, that's the first thing. The second thing would be to acknowledge that there is a necessity to deconflict in areas outside of European territory, in the Middle East, in North Africa, where Russia is present, and de facto, Europeans are deconflicting with Russia. They are. So let's not pretend that there is no degree of, exchange even on the military side with Russia. There has to be, considering that both sides are present in the same conflict areas. So so deconflicting and avoiding strategic surprises, and then a medium-term goal would be to have a new arms control architecture in Europe in place. And I think that's one of the key things that is really driving Macron and his approach to Russia, is really that Europe has to be part of the future of arms control. First, arms control has to be renewed. We need some agreements for dual system and intermediate range nuclear systems. We need that, and Europe needs to be at the table. And the only way to do that is to create this confidence building architecture, right? So a degree of dialogue is necessary in order to even start this conversation. So I think that's the desired end state. And I think when we have other Europeans being extremely cautious with regards to Macron's approach to Russia, it's unclear, in my view, when you listen to them, what is the desired end state. They don't want to talk to Russia. They don't, you know, they see Russia as a threat. Okay, but then, what do they want to achieve? And I think where Macron's approach has at least some value is that he's specifying what he's trying to achieve, which objectives he has.
So, but what would those be? Because I think some of the criticism stems from the fact that he'll make kind of these grand visionary statements about resetting relations with Russia, but then it does, because the how do you get there is a little bit less clear, that it is triggering some resistance from the Baltic countries, Eastern European countries, in a way that may be divisive to the EU. So you talk a little bit about Ukraine, and so he's willing, he has trying to re-stimulate the Minsk II process. Arms control is another issue. But are there we talk about this new security architecture and incorporating Russia into that, but what does that look like? Is he able to put things on the table and bring the rest of Europe along with him? Or is he just kind of out front breaking things without a clear plan that is really kind of anxiety provoking for a lot of other Europeans?
Well, I mean, I think there's a few points. First, you have to look at the strategic environment in which he's operating, which is he's had two U.S. administrations in a row, the Obama administration and the Trump administration, that A, have refused from intervening more broadly in the Middle East, especially in Syria, where Russia intervened and now is the key political actor there, with direct consequences in terms of security, migration, terrorism for Europeans. So there is a sense that you need to find a way, like other allies in the United States, like Israel, that talks to Russia much more than France does, need to find a way to deconflict and find common ground and common interest. And it's the same thing on Ukraine. At the end of the day, the Obama administration left France and Germany take the political lead in negotiation within the Normandy format. Sanctions were taken by the United States, but they're much more costly to European economies, and European sanctions are much more effective because of the deeper trade ties between Europe and Russia. So I think he's also operating in context where he feels that it's up to Europeans to take the lead and to take initiative to try to reshape that that security architecture. Ukraine is a key, of course, a key security interest for Europeans. There's the question of the Middle East. There's the question of arms control. So how do you get there? I think this is why he is so far ambitious on the vision and the rhetoric, but hasn't really given in on substance or clearly on policy, because I think this is why he's more cautious than we think on issues like sanctions or giving in on substance. But I think it's at least to create a new momentum for a dialogue.
Yeah, I think it's about creating the conditions for dialogue. And then obviously whatever it is that happens between Russia and Europe will have to be the product of a consensus, right? So he cannot just unilaterally decide this is what I want to personally achieve with Russia. What he's putting on the table is a set of issues that need to be talked about by both sides, and then it's to use that spaghetti analogy, that he's throwing a lot of spaghetti on the wall, seeing what sticks, both with Europeans and with Russia, and probably where there is a limited consensus is where the initiatives are going to move forward.
Yeah, and I think this is really an important point. I think one of the big mistakes that was made in this sort of new opening since Brégançon last summer is the fact that it was really seen as unilateral. And I think he didn't... it's paradoxical, by the way. When Macron went to China, he had in his delegation a European commissioner and a German minister. And I think it would be fairly low cost for him to try to do the same with European partners. And I think going to Poland recently was a very good step in the right direction in this, and trying to at least explain, trying to push back against some of the the concern, some of the conspiracy theories also sometimes are circulating about this. So at least do more explaining on this approach. Munich, I think, was also pretty positive in that respect, because there is very legitimate fears and concerns coming from our Central and Eastern European partners.
Do you think that Macron came away from the NATO summit happy about this period of reflection that the SecGen kind of, the bone they kind of threw Macron after his interview? You know, he was talking about NATO being brain dead, and we've got to talk about these things at NATO. And of course, there was a lot of running around, I'm sure, at NATO headquarters trying to figure out what to do about that. And so they have this period of reflection. Is he... I mean, I would, if I were him, I would not be very happy about it, because it does sound like a bone being thrown by the alliance. But maybe not. Maybe he can grab onto that and make something of it. And then once they have completed it, what does this mean? Is it the prelude to a new strategic concept? Just what is this? Is a question that certainly has not been answered yet. So what do you think? Did he come away happy, or did he come away disappointed and a little miffed?
I think one positive thing that came out of the NATO summit for France was the Trump-Macron press conference was Trump supported Macron in many ways. He was much more positive in his language than he usually was, than he had been before. And so I think in terms of the bilateral U.S.-France relationship, that was kind of reassuring. But then when it comes to the perhaps a new strategic concept or the reflection process that is ongoing, I think one of the risks, if we think from a French perspective, is that this would, the panel of experts maybe would come up with sort of new missions for NATO, right?
Yeah.
NATO missions regarding China or regarding new technologies, which traditionally from a French perspective is not what NATO is for.
Yeah.
You know, there is still that understanding that NATO is mostly for is chiefly for territorial defense and also for building interoperability between the armed forces and being more efficient when conducting military operations. But I don't think that a more all-encompassing NATO that would deal with China and new technologies would be the French favored way, and that's kind of what risks coming out of the process.
Yeah, you know, Josh Klim also used to say that when you want to bury a problem, you create a committee. And I think it's always tough to ask big bureaucracies to reform themselves. We're still waiting for the French National Assembly to pass a bill that would reduce the number of members by a third. It's not happening for some reason. So, you know, I'm personally skeptical of these efforts. That being said, it's clearly seen as a success, legitimately so, in Paris, that an interview in The Economist created such a wide debate.
Yeah.
And for a few weeks, you know, and the fact that heads of state, that experts, that, you know, the media had to comment on it and debate about it, did show that he tapped into something.
Yeah.
It did show that clearly there was a form of discomfort with a lot of things that are going on with the transatlantic relationship, with the role that the United States is playing, with our institutions, and that we need to have this debate. How does it come from inside these organizations? It comes from in a more disruptive way from outside. I think that's up for debate. But it's interesting. I mean, look, I'm sure we're going to talk about it. But another example that is seen as a clear success in Paris is the European reaction to his proposals on EU enlargement. A few months ago, France opposed the opening of accession talks for Albania and North Macedonia and said that the enlargement procedures, the methodology, was obsolete, wasn't functioning anymore. We have countries like Turkey and Serbia that are stuck in it and where rule of law has backslided.
It's kind of a brain dead in the EU kind of thing.
Totally. And so Macron said we need to make this process more political. We need also to give the possibilities of really suspending application if necessary. And so the French proposed a new methodology. It was adopted in only a couple months. I mean, the Commission came up with its own methodology that included a lot of the French proposals, and it's now been adopted in France. And Macron said in Munich that he would lift his opposition to North Macedonia and Albania. And so it has been a brutal and disruptive way to deal with it. That's true. But at the same time, it had clear effect. And I think this is seen in Paris as a success of his diplomacy.
Yeah. Yeah, about NATO, we talk a lot about the transatlantic aspect of the alliance, and obviously the other elephant in the room is Turkey. And I think when we talk about the future of NATO and the reflection process, etc., I think a lot of consideration has to be given to internal mechanisms within the alliance and intra-alliance relations. And here I see NATO remaining stuck, especially with the worsening now of relations between the EU and Turkey with the opening of borders by Erdogan, and also Turkey's actions in Libya and around the island of Cyprus. I think the relationships between the EU and Turkey are at an all-time low right now. And I mean, we can't talk about NATO and the future of the alliance without taking that into account. And I think the brain death analogy again mostly was interpreted as referring to Trump, but actually in his interview he was mostly referring to Turkey and what would happen if Turkey was to trigger an Article 5. And I think that's where we have made no progress.
Right.
We had a lot of analogies floating around the brain death, but I also really like Alice's throw a lot of spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks. And one of those pieces of spaghetti is the France's nuclear strategy. And I know Jim wanted to ask a question along on that front.
This is something that we talked about before we went on the air, and it's a great issue that could really take up one whole Brussels sprouts. And I know we're almost out of time, but just to throw your way this, you know, it started about a year ago on Twitter, I can't remember who it was, but it was a German came out and was kind of, you know, musing about, hey, you know, maybe that there should be some type of German bomb or German relationship with another country that has a bomb, and should we? And it was just set off this very interesting debate, and I am just shocked that a year later it's got some legs to it. And so, you know, I think it was yesterday the French government released, I think it was a white paper that was the vehicle to respond to. I think the German white paper came out responding to these French proposals that Macron has made. And of course, part of it was on the nuclear side. And so just looking at the nuclear issue generally, where do you think this is going? Will this be just fodder for the think tanks? Or do you think this is going to get some credibility within the senior levels of in Berlin and in Paris?
Well, I will say I don't understand the backlash that this is getting in some European countries or in the United States. I think anything that goes in the direction of Europeans taking more steps in solidarity of each other and taking more responsibility for their own defense should be applauded and encouraged. Some people are saying France is trying to kick the United States out of Europe. I mean, France is a member of a full member of NATO. I don't think French nuclear deterrence for its partners is incompatible in any shape or form with American deterrence. And France wouldn't have the capacity to do so if it wanted to, but it doesn't want to. You know, it reminds me some of the same debates over nuclear deterrence that were going on in the 60s, where initially the United States opposed French having its autonomous nuclear deterrence capabilities, and then the UK. I mean, this famously led to a series of escalating crises that led to France's withdrawal from the NATO military command in 1966. And then just a decade later, the United States recognized that having European partners with their own nuclear deterrence was a value added to the alliance. So I think this is part of basically France showing to its European partners, including Baltic states and others, that their sovereignty, their security is considered a vital natural interest of France. And that is something that should be clearly, I think, applauded in every capital.
Yeah, I think the great emphasis that Macron put on the European dimension of the French vital interests and thereby of the French nuclear deterrent served several purposes. One was to reassure Europeans about Macron's intentions because, you know, as we just mentioned, there are quite a few initiatives that he took in foreign policy that other Europeans were not initially so convinced about. So in assuring the Europeans that, yes, France is there to, you know, it has their back, basically, and the Europeans are part of the French vital interest, I think was important symbolically. Then the more practical step of creating a dialogue with Europeans and including potentially, you know, including them in military exercises that are related to deterrence is important for one of the French missions, if you like, in nuclear deterrence, which is to, I quote, teach the Europeans the grammar of deterrence, right? To include those countries in the thought process that is behind nuclear deterrence and the possession of nuclear weapons, and that reaches from, you know, the capabilities that one needs to the strategy to the objectives, and that then also helps, you know, discuss issues that are related to nuclear deterrence, which are, you know, which is arms control, non-proliferation, other issues on which France is really active on the international stage and on which Europeans, except for the UK, you know, are really not too well acquainted with.
Right.
And then when it comes to how to go about that, and who are the countries that France could work with, I think Germany, as you were suggesting, is a prime target for this attempted dialogue. And in working with Germany on nuclear strategy, on discussing, you know, objectives and capabilities for nuclear deterrence in Europe, is really important for France to have Germany on board in order to reach out to other Europeans, including in Eastern and Northern Europe, that are much less used to working with France on those issues, because France is not in the NATO nuclear
right.
planning group. And so I think having Germany on board is necessary in order to sort of broaden the scope of this European thinking about the role of nuclear weapons in the 21st century.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting to put this in the broader context of how France and Macron views the transatlantic relationship. Because when you hear sometimes Europeans, Americans describing concepts like strategic autonomy or European sovereignty as being anti-American or opposed to the United States, there's often, I find this very paradoxical, because at the same time, you know, Jim Mattis said that France was becoming the partner of choice of the U.S. military, because France is the country that Donald Trump visited the most in this presidency, and I would argue that Macron is probably the foreign leader that he speaks to the most. And I think in this respect, the French have a much less sentimental view of the transatlantic relationship, but they take the United States as it is, and they hear what both President Obama and President Trump, very different styles, have signals to Europeans, which is, we need your free riding, we need you to invest more, we need you to take more responsibility. And this is something that actually French policymakers tend to agree with, and saying, yeah, Europeans do need to take more responsibility. They will become better allies if they invest in their own sovereignty and autonomy. And the nuclear dimension, I think, is within that framework. So there's absolutely nothing contradictory between being a strong member of the Atlantic Alliance and at the same time being investing much more in European sovereignty and autonomy.
Yeah, there's a frustrating tension between those two.
Yeah. I think just a final word on that is indeed this nuclear deterrence speech has to be understood within the context of the ambition for European strategic autonomy, and that the French vision is that the strategic autonomy goes from the European industrial base, including the defense industrial base, to emerging technologies diplomacy and nuclear deterrence. And the Germans have been saying, well, yeah, but we can't have this same vision of strategic autonomy because we don't have a nuclear deterrent. And what France is saying is, well, actually, you know, you do, and we are part of the same alliance, and we have the same vital interests. So you have to be involved as well in this conversation.
And it will be interesting to see if this does get some legs as an issue, and it gets into on the breakfast tables of a French farmer or a German rare bookseller, and they actually start talking about a French, German, or a European nuclear capability over and above what they've kind of grown used to with the U.S. and NATO particularly. And, you know, if this gets on their agenda to talk about, and it becomes a political reality that, in fact, the people embrace it and say, we do want to do this. We do feel this is important for autonomy. And in this new era, we embrace a cooperation on the nuclear side between these two countries. Will that happen, or will they just shy away and go, nuclear, you got to be kidding me. We don't want to get into that. That's for other people like the U.S. We keep us out of that.
Well, I think we could probably talk about this all day, but we're towards the end of our time. And, you know, we didn't plan it this way, but this really was the perfect send-off for Jim.
It really is.
Headed to France on Friday,
unless
right?
I said something wrong and then you stop me at Charles de Gaulle and put me into a quarantine, political quarantine.
So we'll bid Jim farewell for 6 weeks?
6 weeks.
All right. And then we'll be filling in, hopefully, with some guest hosts and other fun ways to keep everyone entertained during coronavirus when everyone may have more time on their hands than they planned, as all of our events are being canceled.
And I look forward to Andrea visiting me in Paris so we can do a Brussels sprouts remote from Sciences Po.
I hope so.
But anyway, thanks to Alice and Ben for joining us.
Guys.
This was really fantastic, and we'll hopefully have you back again.